Good evening, everybody, and welcome to CSIS. I'm Andrew Schwartz, and I'm our Chief Communications Officer here. So good to have everybody here, especially on a rainy night, and I'm really thrilled to have my three favorite colleagues here, actually. Two of which are mentors, actually all three are mentors of mine, and so without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Bob Schieffer.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you all for coming. I would just begin this by saying, in other news, what a day.
Is there anything else happening?
No, a little TV thing. But so we're here to talk about cyber and David Sanger's new book, and it's a good one. David, as you all know, covers national security for the New York Times, and in 36 years at the Times, he has shared three Pulitzers. He's written two previous best-selling books about national security, and I would say that the two interviews that he and Maggie Haberman did with Donald Trump during campaign, the last campaign, gave us the best and really the most definitive look at understanding Donald Trump's views on foreign policy and his knowledge of foreign policy. David is also a good friend of CSIS, as many of you know. Joining us also to talk about David's book, somebody who knows a lot about cyber, our Senior Vice President, CSIS, James Lewis. He was a Foreign Service officer, went on to hold a broad range of political, military, and intelligence assignments for the government. He's recognized as an expert on cybersecurity. He was the Commerce Department head for national security and espionage concerns related to high technology trade with China. He has testified numerous times before Congress on the effect of technology on warfare and how the internet has changed our politics. After 9/11, David Sanger's colleague at the New York Times, Tom Friedman, observed that what happened was not a lack of intelligence, but a lack of imagination. And by that he meant no one could have imagined something like 9/11 happening, and so we really did not have a defense against it. Well, now comes David's book, which is called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age, which is at once an encyclopedic summary of everything cyber, from accounts to how it is used by the United States, how it has been used against the United States, and how are we prepared to deal with it from here on. It's gotten rave reviews, and I would characterize it in one word, and that is alarming. I might even say more than alarming, because as one reviewer put it, the most disturbing theme in this book is the degree to which policymakers remain oblivious to the threat. So why don't we start there? David, just give us your view of what this book is about, sure, why you decided to write it, and what are the things we need to be thinking about because you've written this book.
Well, first, thanks to everybody for coming out. It turns out you had other things you could be doing today, like you could have stayed out of the rain and watched this sort of train wreck of hearings that was going on, and instead you decided to come out and hear us, so we're this is the dedicated group. And to my friend Bob and to Jim, thank you very much for having me here to go do this. I've learned a huge amount from Bob over the years in the world of journalism, and a huge amount from Jim on the cyber issues. So he can, you know, take credit for any part of the book he agrees with and tell me that I wasn't listening right for
I thought you were going to say I could take credit for any part of the book that was wrong.
Oh, well, you can do that too. Starting in the end of the Bush administration, I began to be increasingly attuned to the degree to which a small number of intelligence officials, policymakers, were attuned to what cyber might be able to go do. And in a book I wrote that came out just as President Obama was about to take office called The Inheritance, I revealed that President Bush had actually authorized some computer operations against the Iranian nuclear program, the details of which we didn't know, and the code name for that program, Olympic Games, we didn't know. In fact, I'm not even sure the code name had been given to the operation by that time. But in that book, I sort of explored how this might get used, and that was basically 11 years ago. By the middle of the Obama administration, we suddenly saw one summer afternoon the code that turned out to be at the core of Olympic Games, something called Stuxnet, begin to get copied all around the world. It had escaped from the Natanz nuclear enrichment plant where the Israelis and the US had implanted it. It was a brilliant piece of code because it was one of the most sophisticated efforts to use a cyber weapon in place of an attack that would otherwise be done by sending in saboteurs or dropping bombs. It spun up and sped up and slowed down the centrifuges, which spin at supersonic speeds to enrich uranium, to the point that they exploded and left the Iranians wondering, was this a manufacturing error? Was someone messing with them? The brilliance of it was not only that it worked, but that it was so hard to trace and so hard for the Iranians to figure it out until that moment when the code started spreading around the world and they suddenly realized what was going on. In the debates in the Obama administration, which had inherited this program from President Bush, about whether or not to go use the weapon, President Obama said to his aides at some point, you're not likely to read much about this in his memoir when it comes out, because it's all, the US has never admitted its role in this, but he said to his aides, look, eventually when people figure out what it is we're doing here, it's going to be the excuse for every other nation that's already using cyber against us to come out and do it more forcefully. And in fact, at the time that I wrote about Stuxnet, about Olympic Games, it was hard to find another sophisticated cyber attack that was state on state. There was a lot of criminal stuff going on, a lot of other things. When we went off to do a count when I was working on this book, we got somewhere over 200 or 250 just in the past 6 years since Stuxnet had happened. So the Obama warning turned out to be right. It was the Iranians against the Saudis. It was the North Koreans against Sony to try to stop the distribution of a truly bad movie called The Interview. If you haven't seen it yet, I can save you 2 hours of your life right now. Right? Okay. It was, of course, the Russians against our election system, but before that, Russian attacks, which seemed at first to be just about surveillance against the State Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the White House, which the United States never called the Russians out about. And Bob, one of the big arguments of the book is not only that politicians have an inferior understanding of the potential of this weapon, but also that we've wrapped way too much secrecy around the weapon. We've done it because there's a natural tendency in the intelligence world to say anything you talk about our capabilities or what we see our adversaries doing will reveal something that will give advantage to the enemy. When in fact, what we're doing is stepping on our own deterrence. We're also preventing a debate in this country about how we want to go use this weapon. And that's sort of my last point about why I wrote it. In the nuclear age, we had a very vigorous debate about whether or not we wanted to use nuclear weapons. And it ended in a completely different place than it started. It started with MacArthur wanting to drop the bomb on the Chinese and the North Koreans. And it ended in the 80s or 90s with us deciding we would only use nuclear weapons as a very last resort. We have never had that debate about cyber, because it doesn't have the huge effects of nuclear weapons. You can dial it up, you can dial it down, you can adjust it. It's a short of war weapon. but the potential use is so devastating, and we've never gotten into the argument about what should be off limits.
Let me just ask Jim, give us a picture of what a country that decides to use this, and there are a number of countries now that know about this and some more than others. What can you do with cyber?
What do you call it in the book? You call them the Seven Dwarfs? Is that what?
No, seven. I call them the Seven Sisters,
Well,
but they
close.
Could be the Seven Dwarfs too, if you like that better.
Yeah, I like it better. And so there's seven countries that have the capability to cause major consequences using cyber techniques. And we're one, the Brits, the Israelis, those are the good guys. The Chinese, the Russians, a bunch of others. And the dilemma is...
North Koreans.
Them. Yes. So I was thinking while David was talking about a story I heard about Marshal Foch, who was the Allied commander in World War I. And in 1912, people showed him an airplane. And he said, this will make a really good replacement for the bicycle, right? Because he didn't realize the potential. And 4 years later, no military could engage without airplanes. And we're at that point now. No military can engage without cyber. It's not one of the problems we have is it doesn't map perfectly. The book brings this out. It doesn't map perfectly to kinetic effect. You know, there's other things you can do with it, and we saw that in 2016. So countries have started to engage each other in a new kind of conflict. And they have so far been somewhat circumspect, and I think we're all waiting to see if that's going to change.
But if they chose...
Just to build on his analogy here, yeah. I didn't bring my slides today, I spared you. But the opening slide I usually use when I'm describing the book is a picture of the Wright brothers out at what is now the soccer field at College Park at the university, showing the military, the Wright military flyer to a bunch of generals in 1908. And as they fly it around, the generals say, this is terrific. We can fly this over enemy lines, we'll see their vulnerabilities, and we'll send in the cavalry. Nobody actually talked about arming the damn thing, okay? So here we were in 1918, as Jim says, you know, no military could be without it. And 37 years after the Wright brothers show this, we use an airplane to drop an atomic bomb that nobody obviously could have imagined in 1908. And that's the humility we have to enter this with, that we know what the delivery vehicle is right now, but we don't know what the weapon looks like.
Well, I mean, it even goes, a misunderstanding of technology goes even earlier than that, because the U.S. military, when they first fought the Comanche Indians out in the West, thought the way you fought them was you'd ride out to the battleground, dismount, and then try to charge them on foot. The Comanches quickly convinced them, and they were able to fire 17 arrows while they were reloading their musket. They did it all from horseback. And so
made for great TV, didn't it?
Well, it did, but it's one of the best. But I want to get back to just how lethal this weapon can be. I mean, you can turn off people's lights. Talk to me about what is possible.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is that right now it's hard to find examples where people have died. We think it's probably happened, but where people have died as a result of a cyber attack.
I don't think people have died.
Right. So there's some arguments about the people who were sent down to go inspect what was going on down in the centrifuge hall in Iran. That wasn't really a good place to be when the centrifuges were blowing up, but we'll never know, okay. Mm-hmm. So, but for right now, for a weapon this powerful, it's fascinating that no one really has. But, as you say, if the power goes off, you know, hospitals,
water,
emergency communication systems, people are gonna die at some point. And one of the fascinating things is you could imagine setting up a set of norms, I discuss this at the end of the book, a sort of digital Geneva Convention to try to prevent deaths to civilians by saying, okay, what's off limits? Electric grids, water supplies, nursing homes, hospitals, you know, whatever. election systems. But I'm betting that if you sent that list around the U.S. government, and we'll have to ask Jim, who spent more time in the U.S. government than I have, but just in talking to my contacts within the intelligence community, and you said, here's a list, we're going to go out and negotiate this so that people don't die, I think the intel community would come back and say, we don't want to sign up to this. I mean, election systems, we manipulated elections in Italy in 1948, in Latin America in the 50s. We had a coup against the Iranians. They still remember it, we don't. Would you want to take away from the president the opportunity to peacefully settle something that we might otherwise send us to war? Similarly, we had an operation we were planning against Iran. If we went to war against Iran, you read about it in the book, it was called Nitro Zeus, that would basically have unplugged Tehran ahead of any actual battle. The thought being that you could end the war before you even had to fire a shot. But don't kid yourself, a lot of people would have died.
So, when the North Koreans, when we first began to worry about North Korea and their nuclear capabilities and their ability to build missiles that could deliver them to U.S. shores, they had a lot of problems.
They did.
In the beginning.
They did. They had an 88% failure rate with an older missile system that was pretty well understood and had been tested a lot by the Russians. And it was sort of one of those things where their failure rate should have been closer to about 14% if they were alone, right? So Bill Broad, my colleague at the Times, and I started looking at this and we're saying, how come every time the North Koreans go off and do a test here, it falls into the ocean? I mean, you realize this was getting bad when late night comedians were beginning to, you know, show video and so forth, right? And we dug into it, having been sensitized by Olympic Games, and sure enough, found that in January of 2014, President Obama had ordered an acceleration of a smaller program the U.S. had already had underway, in which they basically were sabotaging the missile launches. Now, one of the interesting things is it's very hard to tell how successful the program was. Every time a missile went under, the cyber people in the Pentagon would go in and do a little bit of a war dance to get more budget money for their programs. And other people would say, well, how do you know this was cyber? Could have been the bad parts we've been sending in, could have been engineering mistakes, these are the North Koreans after all, you know, could have been all kinds of things. What is interesting is that in October of 2016, when we were kind of focused on other things, Kim Jong-un killed the program and rolled out another missile program that he had basically ready to roll. And we've been very unsuccessful against that one. And that's the one that was so successful at doing the long-range missile.
Jim, is there any doubt in your mind, or can you say that we were responsible for those early failures that they were having?
As your spiritual advisor, I must say that I have to intervene because there's some grave theological errors in what you've said. First, no one's going to just use cyber by itself. It's not going to, why bother, right? And so when you talk to the Russians and the Chinese, what they say is, you guys have assembled a portfolio of new technologies, hypersonic strike, PGMs, UAVs, space, and cyber, that allows you to achieve strategic effect without using nuclear weapons. And this undercuts our deterrence. They've been saying that now for about 4 years. And their answer is, of course, well, we better build our own. So the key here is to blend. And so when the people in the military think about cyber now, they ask, how do I blend it with other technologies to get advantage? Second, I don't worry so much about kinetic effect. I mean, it's there. As David pointed out, one of the problems is that we've discussed in secret, of course, is there's a radar facility. I don't like it. And so I blow it up.
There's a what?
Radar facility, an air defense facility. I don't like it. And so I blow it up. And I know it's blown up because there's a big smoking hole. There's a radar facility and I don't like it and I launch a cyber attack against it. How do I know I got it? So there is this degree of uncertainty. And that means that people have been toying with political effect, and the Russians in particular, it's in their military doctrine. How do I achieve confusion? How do I increase the fog of war? How do I increase friction? So there's another aspect, and you have it in the book. The third part is, and this is, you're right in saying the U.S. and its allies would not accept constraints that took certain targets off limit. And this is a hard one for people to understand, except in actual negotiations, because under current international law, you're supposed to make reasonable efforts to not harm civilians unless there's overriding military necessity. And if there's overriding military necessity, you can shoot any target. And nobody wants to give that up. And I wouldn't give it up myself. So it's a little bit more complicated. We've had discussions in the UN about how do we torque the laws. Laws that were designed for cavalry, how do you make them work for cyber? And you know, it's no one wants to tell what they can do, and not everyone can do it. It's a very difficult
situation. Our secrecy is so great that not only won't we tell this in negotiations with our adversaries, but you go ask, you go to NATO, which Donald Trump famously said was obsolete. And when it comes to cyber, they weren't obsolete. They never really got into the race. In fact, one time I was doing reporting on this, and I was at the old NATO headquarters. They've since moved. And I'm walking down the hall, and I see this sign that says, Thursday, Windows XP training. Okay. So here is a, 15-year-old version of Windows that is basically the Russians' favorite version of Windows, because it's so ridden with holes and so unsupported and unpatched that that's how they mounted a lot of their attacks on Ukraine. And here is NATO training people in XP. So one of the few moments when I've heard Donald Trump say something like, NATO is so obsolete, I'm thinking to myself, you know, he may actually be on to something here.
Well, what you're seeing is, putting aside the utility of NATO, which is not something I work on, a new cyber alliance is emerging, and its core is what they call the Five Eyes, our five closest allies, at least one of whom is as good as we are. And then you're adding additional...
You're talking about the British.
European partners, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a new... You can't... what country should I be mean to in NATO? I won't be mean, but there's some countries in NATO you just don't want to tell things to, right? Because you may as well send it, copy Moscow on the email, right? So there's a new alliance emerging. What that will look like, I don't know. But it's come up in how do we, the debate internally now is a lot, is how do we impose consequences? Do we tell our allies? Do we tell the guy we're going to impose consequences on before, after? And so you need more trusted partners. Some of the smaller European countries, and I'll pick the Swedes and the Dutch, they are pretty darn good. So we're seeing countries, to your point, they all kind of said, hey, this cyber thing, I better get on it.
A good example of what he's saying, as I describe in the book takes you into GCHQ, which is the British equivalent of the National Security Agency. And the guy who was running GCHQ in 2016, when the Russians were coming into our system, is sitting in the Donut, which is this giant circular building in the Cotswolds that the British have built for this thing. It's actually, Apple looked at it when they were designing their new headquarters, which looks very much like it. And he discovers these intercepts that the British picked up before we did, of Democratic National Committee emails, you could see the headers, running through the Russian intelligence system. And he actually sent a note to the head of the NSA saying, hey, you guys have a little problem out here. And he got back a very polite thank you note. You'll be glad to know the NSA writes really nice thank you notes. The follow-up was less than impressive, but the thank you note was really terrific.
Well, one thing, we have not talked about yet is it is not just a weapon of war. It's a very handy tool for thieves. You have a very good story in your book about the North Koreans stealing money.
That's right. So it has been used for criminal use for a long time. And you know, you think about the different uses of cyber, and there's espionage, just a faster, better way to do that. Data manipulation, what we worry about when we worry about, for example, changing votes or changing blood types in a military database or something like that. There is, of course, the use that we were describing in the Olympic Games or what Sony did against, or what North Korea did against Sony, the destroy material. But then there's, and there's information operations. But in the world of data manipulation, it's a great way to steal large amounts of money pretty quickly. So the North Koreans broke into the Bangladeshi Central Bank, figured out how they communicate with the SWIFT system, which clears international transactions, and those move through the New York Fed, and arranged for the transfer of $1 billion into their accounts that they had set up in the Philippines. And they would have gotten all billion, they got 81 million, until somebody in the New York Fed, a German woman actually, for whom English was not her first language, recognized a spelling error in the North Korean transfer notes. They spelled foundation.
It's just which is how it's spelled in Korean, by the way.
Right. So. It's just like your mother always said, proofread everything, you know. So anyway, in the course of that, what happens? They get caught. But it's not the only time that they have used cyber to do theft on a very large scale. And what's fascinating about it is this wasn't criminal theft. This was theft by the state. This was just another way of financing the North Korean regime.
And yet, for all of this, this is something that is almost unknown, except outside of expert circles in think tanks in places like this. How is that? I mean, how has that happened? I mean, we've been talking about deterrence against nuclear weapons since I was in high school. And the debate continues to go on. We talk about ABMs, we talk about treaties and stuff. Nothing on this. Is it because people don't understand it? Is it because we don't have the imagination to see what's happened?
If Jim's answer first, I may have a different one than he does.
But. He will have a different, but I was going to say, you two guys are reporters, and so you like openness. And I used to tell my wife, what they don't know won't hurt them, and the they was you. Right. Why do you think we need a debate on this? Why there's a democratic principle that, yeah, we should talk about this, blah, blah, blah. The debate is so dreadful. The debate is so dreadful. I mean, now everyone and their dog is a cybersecurity expert, and sometimes the dog is actually the better interlocutor. What would a debate bring us? Why do we want to be open?
Well, it might make
like
people aware that we have that there's a threat to our national security.
Yeah.
That is what I would say is my answer.
Mm. Let me, I think Bob's right, that if you don't openly debate it, you don't force people to go learn about it.
Or at least make people aware of it.
Right.
You know.
Secondly, in the nuclear age, people felt pretty helpless. There wasn't a huge amount they could go, you know, they couldn't have much effect on this. Mm-hmm. But in the cyber age, you're worried about cyber issues every single day. You're worried at the criminal level about whether or not somebody takes off with your credit card number, when your autonomous car shows up, you're a little bit worried about whether when you tell it to go to the supermarket that somebody may have reprogrammed it to go over a cliff. That worries you. You're worried about the fact that your house is so much more vulnerable than it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, you probably had one or two things connected to the internet, a desktop computer and maybe a laptop. Today, you've got all of those and your smart TV and your Alexa and your alarm system. And you know, probably four cell phones, and all of these have opened up new threat vectors, new ways to get into your house. So one reason we need to debate it more generally, Jim, is the old line of it can't hurt you, today it can hurt you, okay? Mm. Secondly, we are the collateral damage in this state-on-state war taking place 30,000 feet over our heads, so it's not like we're not affected. That gets to your point, Bob, about why the political debate about this is so awful. And when I go out and I talk to politics, there's a small group of people on Capitol Hill who I would say are quite savvy about this. You know, you talk to Mark Warner about these things, he knows, you know, what it is. You talk to Adam Schiff about them, he understands. People who are on the right committees for looking at it and have an interest in it. The vast majority, their first answer to me is, something along the lines of, you know, I don't really understand this stuff, but when I need to get advice on it, I go to my, you know, 15-year-old grandchild. And what I want to do is sort of reach out, if I could break out of my repertorial neutrality and grab them and say, during the Cold War, would it have been an acceptable answer to say on nuclear weapons, you know, this nuclear physics stuff, it's so complicated. I go to my 15-year-old daughter to understand nuclear physics. Of course you wouldn't, because the country seemed to be, you know, at peril. It would have been political suicide to say that in the nuclear age. It's cute in the cyber age.
Well, I mean, I see things like in the paper the other day, I see where John Bolton announced, the National Security Advisor, that he has eliminated the position of the cybersecurity coordinator
at
the
National
Security Council.
Yeah.
So. What does that mean? What does that mean to you, Jim?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. Well, you do it.
Oh, but it would be so much more fun if you did it. I'll be glad to. But here, I'll tell you what, I'll start and you finish. Okay. So I thought that the Trump administration actually started pretty well with this. They had a Homeland Security advisor, Tom Bossert, who had spent a lot of time working on cyber issues and, you know, was pretty familiar with them. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could conduct a pretty detailed conversation. He was also there at a rough time when the shadow brokers material began to get out, which, if any of you missed it, was a leak that was far worse than anything Snowden did. It was the actual leak of the code around our cyber weapons. But because it didn't have an individual like Snowden, it wasn't there. Then Tom hired a man named Rob Joyce, who used to run the Tailored Access Operations Unit of the NSA. This is the group that breaks into foreign computer systems. And if you wanted to have somebody to go defend the United States on a broad scale and think about our vulnerabilities, best person to hire is someone who spent their life breaking into foreign computer systems, right? And so that was the team. And you could agree or disagree with the decisions they were making, but they certainly knew the topic really, really well. When Bolton came in, Mr. Bossert was gone within about 2 days, and Mr. Joyce went back to the NSA after a month or two, and his position was eliminated. And the answer that John Bolton gave about this when he announced a new cyber strategy last week himself was that we don't have special coordinators for a lot of other jobs, so this didn't fit bureaucratically within the National Security Council. And I thought that represented, a lack of understanding of how cross-cutting these cyber issues are around the government and the need to coordinate our offensive and defensive policies, because in cyber, it's frequently a blur between those two. What did I miss?
So one of the effects has been that I think they want to push authority back to the agencies, and the Obama White House was, you know, particularly large, and as many presidents do, particularly by the end, accumulated responsibility, line responsibility, not strategery, because the agencies can be unresponsive. And so now you see DHS, DOD, DOJ, all stepping up to play a bigger role in cyber. I think that will ultimately result in the kind of coordination problems you're talking about. But it's a reasonable thing to say, I want to shrink the NSC. When I was in the NSC, we could have staff meetings in the Indian Treaty Room, which could hold about 40 or 50 people. They would have needed a room this size for in late 2016. I think that's going to be the test, is will the agencies fight among each other? Will they actually work together? What I worry about is that, just as a culture, we're just very slow to make decisions anymore. And so,
well, let me just ask you this, Jim. Do you think cyber poses a threat to America's security?
Oh, how could anyone not think that? On so many levels, it's a threat. Whether you go back to when we originally saw it as an intelligence problem, to the things that you outlined in the book, no, it's a threat.
Well, are we doing what we need to be doing to defense against that?
Short answer is no.
No.
We were probably the leading country in terms of thinking about cybersecurity in 2008, 2009, and the rest of the world has kind of moved on, and we are behind. The other issue just is, and there's, so if you look at the trajectory, first emphasis was on, hardening systems, making them difficult targets. Second step was we'll develop international norms, get people to agree to rules. We're at a third step now that is, things will not change until we impose consequences on our attackers. And that's difficult, it's risky, but I think there's a general consensus it's what we have to do.
David.
Well, first, to pick up on Jim's last point, there certainly is a consensus that's what we need to do, and that was a big theme of General Paul Nakasone's confirmation hearing. He's the new head of the NSA and U.S. Cyber Command, and he was in on the early days of the development of Cyber Command and has a really deep and sophisticated knowledge of this. But I think that only emphasizes the need to go have the kind of open conversation that we were discussing on this. Because if decision making is being pushed down, and it is in defense, but it also is in offense, then the question is, who is it who goes and makes those decisions? Because you can get on an escalation ladder with a country very fast. And when you get into those sections of the book that describe the debate inside the Obama White House about what to do once they figured out that it was Putin who was behind the election hacks, people came to the president with all kinds of good ideas. Let's expose the holdings of the oligarchs. Let's expose where Putin's hiding his money.
My favorite was leak his Botox injection schedule, which we ultimately did not do. But I was really happy because now he always looks so stern.
Yeah.
It's because he can't move his face.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Do you think that President Trump fully appreciates this whole question of cyber and the threats that it could cause?
There's a section in the book where I go to interview him in those 2016 elections, and I deliberately put, knowing I was working on this book, I put some cyber questions in it, and he said it's very powerful, the cyber, and then talked about how far behind we were, and when I probed him a little on the attacks on Iran, I think I was telling him some new news there on what had happened. But he was, doing some other things at the time we were attacking Iran. I hope he's moved up the line. I think something that's gotten in the way of it has been the Russia investigation. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in the book where he calls me right after the summit with Putin in Hamburg. He got on Air Force One. This was the same trip where they wrote the denial of the creative description of the meeting in Trump Tower. But before they got to the creative description writing, he called me to tell me that Putin had explained to him, as he said publicly many times since, that it couldn't have been the Russians who did the hack on the DNC because they're so good they never would have gotten caught. And I said, well, Mr. President, this isn't the kind of attack that was meant to be hidden. This was actually meant to be seen. That's why they made all this stuff public. And he kind of moved on, So I think the Russia hack has gotten in the way of his thinking strategically about our defenses and our offenses, because he has feared that any detailed discussion of this would only call back into question the legitimacy of his presidency.
Okay, well, let's open it up to questions. Here's a lady on the front row.
Hey, this is the scariest book I've ever read.
No.
Oh,
you want to hold on, Matt. There's a mic coming right to you.
Full disclosure, this is my wife.
And she does get called on first for good reason.
David, this is the scariest book I've ever read. Okay. What I want to know is, what do we do, and this is for you and Jim, personally, I know there's a few hints in the book about what to do about your computer and your, emails and all that stuff. But in a financial situation, the banks go down. Should we be hoarding cash to prepare for that? I mean, I'm serious about this. I think it's a really scary thing. The ATMs go down. Your credit card doesn't work. How do we function in a society like
that.
Well,
if you do stuff cash under your mattress, put it on Bob's side, because it's really lumpy, and you know it's going to be, you know. Look, there are some basic things you can go do. Two-factor authentication has probably been the best single thing, you know, when a code is sent back to your cell phone. Doesn't work terribly well in a country like China or Russia, where the state controls the telecom company, and so when that code comes back, it's coming right back to them as well. But there are basic things you can do. And one of the good news parts of the book, and I agree it's not full with lots of good news, is that our own personal cybersecurity skills have risen up considerably in the past couple of years because we're using techniques like that. The problem is the threat has gotten so much more exponential, and states have begun being the users. So just for the same reason you have locks on your doors and an alarm system, you can protect against sort of 85 or 90% of the drive-by kind of problems. But if a state is going to come after you, there's not a whole lot you're going to do, be able to do, because they're not going to bring down your account. They're going to bring down the whole banking system. And at that point, there's not enough cash around for you to stick under the mattress.
So the Chinese focus mainly on stealing advanced technology and military secrets now. It looks like the 2015 deal is holding. There's some debate over that, so they're not a problem. The Russians...
I heard from the president yesterday they were a problem.
We can come back to that. But, the Russians do engage in cybercrime, but they're kind of like the mafia. In fact, they are the mafia. And so they don't want you to go out of business. They want to be able to skim off money every month or something. And I've had this discussion with both Russian and Chinese counterparts, where the Chinese guy said to me, he said, look, you don't have to worry about us destabilizing Wall Street because we own it, right? And the same is true for the Russians. It would be like breaking their own piggy bank, right? Now, there's a chance that they could make a mistake. I think that's clear. The North Koreans don't have the skills yet. The Iranians don't have the skills yet. Both are progressing rapidly. But right now, people would rather take money than see the system break down. So I don't know if that's a comfort or not. But
all right. Over here. And we do have a mic.
I'm Reed Detchen with the United Nations Foundation. You talked a little bit about the Russian hack meddling election activities. What is your confidence level that the vote counting is occurring in a credible way right now? Is there an ability, and do you think there's a danger, that the vote totals that are reported on election night are inaccurate?
So there's a chapter in the book about Ukraine called Putin's Petri Dish, because everything that they did to us or attempted to do to us, they start out by trying to do in Ukraine. And in Ukraine, they didn't try to actually affect the vote counts in the machines. They got into the reporting system so that when they had a presidential election, the Ukrainian news media came within about 40 minutes of reporting the wrong results, which would have thrown huge chaos. Astoundingly, while the Ukrainians got it right, nobody sent the memo to the Russian news organizations that the vote count, that the hack had been discovered. And so the Russians reported different results than the Ukrainians did. So there are all kinds of ways to play with it. You don't have to actually play with the vote. You can just play with that whole bit. So there are two things I worry about with the vote count system. One is the registration system, because that's what's connected to the internet. That's what's outward facing. So that if Bob and Jim show up at their precinct and somebody has gotten into the registration system, they may be told, oh, looks to me like, Bob, you've moved to Arizona, and Jim, you've moved to New York. And you could imagine the chaos you've created there. It's harder to get at the voting system, partly because it's offline and partly because it's so creaky and old, you know, it's spread out, every state does it differently, that it's really hard to get into. Now, there are individual voting machines you can play with, and I went out talking about the book this summer to DEF CON, this big hacker conference they have in Las Vegas. And they brilliantly
there?
Set a group of 11-year-olds to go try to break into some voting machines that they had bought on eBay when states let them out. And I think they were replicating the Florida system. And they got into it before lunch. They got into it pretty quickly, actually. So you do have to be worried about it. The solution here doesn't seem to me to be that hard. We just need to mandate paper backup, so that even if it took a while to do a count, as it did in 2000, at least you've got something you can do the count from.
All right, on the back there.
Good evening, gentlemen. Adam DiPietrillo from Brown University EMCS. So you mentioned that NATO was very slow.
Until a few months ago when they finally got that going. They did pass a few years ago a new rule that basically said a cyber attack could be considered an attack on all, just as a physical attack can be. You know, Article 5 is an attack on one is an attack on all. It's only been invoked once in defense of us on the day after 9/11. But I think in reality, to get the NATO members to agree that a cyber attack on an individual country meant that everybody should come to their defense, it's really hard to imagine how that would work. So they just don't have their heads around both the offensive element of this and the strategic elements of it.
I'm a little more positive. You have to think of this as a 10-year succession of events, starting with Estonia. And the Estonians said, hey, look, the Russians are screwing with us. Pardon me, the Russians are doing bad things to us. That's Article 5. And the North Atlantic Council, the decision-making body in NATO, said, not so fast. They ultimately settled on Article 4, which is, we'll discuss it. But since that, since 2007, there's been a steady progression. NATO can't, what they used to say is, we're a defensive organization. We can't say cyber offense. So what's code in NATO for cyber offense is active defense. Active defense means you go onto other people's networks and stop them before they do things. So a lot of progress on the NATO side.
Let's have another woman here. All right, Carla.
Cynthia Everett, both State Department and CyberCom, formerly. You keep referring to cyber weapons and cyber, but the military refers to it as the cyber domain, which I think indicates that there's both positive and negative. I mean, it's offensive. It can be an offensive weapon. It can be a defensive weapon. It can be a way of connecting democratic groups together. It can be a way of stealing huge amounts of money from crime. It can also be a way of excellent economic benefit and commercial activities. And whenever I go to meetings, I find that there is a small group of people who are talking about just one of those areas.
That's right.
As if the others don't have any effect at all. And I wonder if you see any chance that we're going to be able to come out of a way where we can talk across the whole range of cyber domain activities.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book and tried to write a non-technical book was to do exactly that. To sort of cover both the defense and offensive dilemmas that this has created, and that big range that goes, as I said, from espionage to data manipulation to offensive operations to influence operations, like we saw. And you know, if we were having this discussion 3 years ago, we'd all be consumed with the vulnerabilities of the electric power grid instead of being consumed with the vulnerabilities of the election system. So that focus that you mentioned depends in some degree, to some degree, on what the headlines have been for the previous, you know, 6 months. And it would be good if we get a broader discussion of that. But to do that, people need to get their heads around what the range of activity is and why messing with an election system is different from an information operation and why that's different from an offensive operation. It would help if your colleagues and former colleagues in Cyber Command and if the State Department, among others, could discuss this much more publicly every single day. Because until you do that, people don't begin to absorb what it is you're debating doing.
Everything is becoming cyber now, right? So I was talking to one of the big airplane companies, and they said, you think of us as a metal bender. We're actually a software company. We haven't caught up with that in our discussion, but you think about, as David was saying, all the stuff in your house and your car and everything. So everything's becoming cyber, and we haven't found a good way to articulate that. It will take time. We just don't have the narrative that explains the range of this, in part because every day it's a little more broad than it was the day before.
And because everything's called a cyber attack. And you know, part of what I deal with in the book is there are things the government will not call a cyber attack, rightly so. So when the Chinese came in and stole those 22 million security files from
OPM.
From OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, the most boring bureaucracy in Washington, but probably also the most tuned out because the Chinese were running this operation for a year before anybody figured it out. And they hadn't encrypted the information that many of you, right? And then they tried to explain to me that that was really okay. And then we noticed that the Chinese encrypted it on their way out as they were stealing it so that we wouldn't see what they were doing. It gets even better, by the way. A few months after they explained to me why they didn't need to encrypt it, somebody sent me a little notice from the Federal Register, which was for a contract to encrypt all this data. So I wrote a little story about it, and I suggested in this that they just give the contract to the Chinese because they'd encrypted it all already. It turned out the general counsel's office over at OPM did not think that was as funny as I did. But
that's too bad because the Chinese encryption isn't particularly good.
Yeah. So, to your point here, we need to get people to understand the range of threats before you can begin to tailor your behavior to each one of those.
Well, I think we've come to the end here. One thing I do know how to do is how to get off on time. So thank you all for coming. And David, thank you very much for doing this book. Let's hope that it causes more dialogue about something that needs to be talked about. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Very much. And thank you.
Thank you.